Good morning. Welcome to Manzanita Voices. I'm your host, Linda Field, and we have a great show lined up for you today, especially if you like animals and wildlife. It's not exactly lions and tigers and bears. How about dolphins and wolves and grizzlies? We'll enter the animal den in just a little bit, but first, of course, I have some announcements for you. First, as always, keep a pen and paper handy to jot down websites and other information because I'm always throwing something at you that you might want to refer to later. Second, I don't want to panic you, but Christmas is just around the corner. Not just Christmas, but other holidays for lots of people. We need something special to do for that, for the Christmas show, and I don't care what religion you are. Just write something to share with us about your holiday. Or, if you don't want to write about your holiday, write about winter, the season. This piece that you send to me can be longer than the 2-minute morning workout. How about a 5-minute story, an essay, a narrative, or a set of poems? It can be shorter than 5 minutes. It just shouldn't take me longer than 5 minutes to read. Make it a cute story or something traditional. How about something sentimental? Heartwarming, funny, whatever. I probably won't have a guest on the 18th of December when the show will air. I'll just do the whole show with whatever you send me, and we'll fill in with holiday music. It should be a nice experience. While you're at it, we have the Thanksgiving holiday coming up too, and that's right around the corner. So send me something about Thanksgiving if you would like, and maybe it'll get on the air. Again, you can go up to 5 minutes for this one. And I have another announcement. All of Manzanita Voices shows will soon be archived on my new website. And I'm saying this to you today, October the 4th. You're not going to hear this show probably until early November. So, and that's how it always works. I always record the show a few weeks before it airs, which is a little bit confusing because it keeps me from announcing special events that are coming up locally, because usually there's not enough time, not enough lead time to get them in. But anyway, I'm telling you this on October the 4th, and I think by November the 4th, we should have the archive shows up and running. And so when you hear the show, go ahead, see if you can get it. I think my website is going to be lindafield@manzamedia.com. That's M-A-N-Z-A media.com. Just give it a try, and maybe you'll see a blog there. You'll see photographs, links to other sites. You'll see a picture of a manzanita shrub so that you know what it looks like. Because those of you in Florida, oh my goodness, we have a listener in Florida. I just got an email from her yesterday. I'm so excited. Our audience is growing more and more all the time, and I'm so pleased. That listener, by the way, is getting a free copy of Manzanita Wild Edges. I'm going to send it out to her in the mail this week. And that's because she's the first person from a new state to contact me. So all of you, contact me for whatever reason at writers@kvgcradio.com. Just think, Voice of the Gold Country, KVGC. So again, my email address, writers@kvgcradio.com. If you live in Minnesota, if you live in Canada, Mexico, Arkansas, some place that I haven't heard from yet, let me know, and you'll get one of our beautiful copies of Wild Edges, the anthology that Manzanita Writers Press put out last year. Okay, I guess we've got everything there taken care of. Now, it is time for the morning workout. As you know, morning workout is a place where I want to have a chance to read something that you have written And we have a really faithful listener in Phoenix, Arizona, named Karen Wolf. Good morning, Karen. How are you doing today? I hope it cooled down there. I know it was in the hundreds last time I checked. Well, thank you for sending us your poem, Karen. I was just really happy to get it. Karen told me in her email to me at writers@kvgcradio.com, she said that she took a trip to Yellowstone National Park, probably to get out of the heat in Phoenix, I don't know. Anyway, several months ago she did that. She went to Yellowstone, and she was enthralled by the place. She had never been there, and she saw lots of wildlife. She wrote a poem that I really enjoyed, and she wanted me to share it with you. So here it is for morning workout. It's called The Wolves of Lamar. Wolves of Lamar by Karen Wolf. Karen, were you going there to visit relatives, you think? Okay, here it is. Wolves of Lamar. I've seen them, the wolves of Lamar Valley, Yellowstone, through early morning mist, by the glistening, meandering river. I've seen the pack. The alpha female confidently leads. Her luxurious coat is clear. The soft white, the gray, the tan, she's healthy and beautiful. Beside her, the alpha male proudly strides. He is strong. His black coat shimmers in the early sun. There's white under his jaw, down his neck and chest. He's incredibly stunning. Behind them, in the tall sage, comes the black beta male. Then, the light gray female, followed by a dark gray male. Further behind, two yearlings shepherd four pups. Four-month-old pups, newly out of their den, are more than the yearlings can manage. The playful pups are up, over, and around fallen logs by the river. At the front of this parade, the alphas stop. They turn to check on the pack. Where are the young ones? The alpha male takes a pose, and I know what's coming. The howl. Yes, that chilling, ancient sound. It cuts the still air. It is haunting. The yearlings reply, and the chorus begins. They all chime in to announce their locations. Even the pups, though theirs is a more yelp than a howl. Hurriedly, the yearlings and pups scent track through the sage to catch up with the adults. Muzzles rub and tails wag upon the reunion. From the overlook, I scan this ancient scene. Bison and elk to the west, a grizzly and cubs in the far tree line. I look back 1,000 years and more on a wild panorama as it was then. The rawness, the wildness, the lore. Now, thank God, I have seen them. That was really nice, Karen. Thank you for your poem. I love wildlife, so you know I liked that poem very much. Now, we have a special guest today. Her name is Helen Bonner, and she's a friend of mine. I met Helen first in a workshop at Gold Rush Writers, where she taught a workshop on memoir, and we've run into each other at Gold Rush every year since then, and we see each other all around, and Helen lives here in Jackson.
I live here in Jackson, and I want to tell the world that all of us writers really appreciate Linda for what she has done, putting us on the air and giving us airspace and making sure people beyond Jackson hear what we're doing.
Well, thank you, Helen. I really appreciate having you as listeners, too. You know, I wouldn't be anywhere without my listeners and without my guests and without the people who send in things for me to read on the air.
Yeah, I love that wolf poem because the wolf is my totem.
Oh, no kidding.
And people say, how do you know what your totem is? Well, for me, wolves come to me in my dreams, so I know that they're my totem.
Oh, no kidding. You dream about them, so they're your totem. I wonder what mine is. I don't know.
Huh? Pay attention to your dream.
Yeah, well, that's good advice. Yeah, the dreams can be pretty interesting. Helen, would you tell me a little bit about what has been your journey through life to get to have written four books. Two of them are memoirs and two of them are novels.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done a screenplay when you were in college and you won an award for that and all this.
I've done stage plays and I've been a writer all my life. You know, once in a while you talk to a little kid and they'll say, I know what I want to be when I grow up. Well, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I just knew that I was a writer. I just wrote. That's what I did. By the time I was in the fourth or fifth grade, I was writing stories. And by the time I was in high school, I'd tried a novel. I read it.
Well,
later.
You were just in high school and you tried a novel?
When I read it 10 years later, I threw it away.
Oh, no. Now, don't you wish you had it now?
And now I wish I had it.
Yeah.
Because I think I would have thought it was charming now, but at the time I thought, oh, my gosh, it's awful. but writing is what I do. And like most writers, I think, I had to find another way to make a living. So I was a college professor. Until recently when I retired to finish up all my writing. And that's been pretty much the story of my writing life.
Uh-huh. And, well, we all know, all of us have lots of other parts, facets to our lives beside the writing life, but the writing can take up quite a big part.
It does.
Yes. Well, now this book that you have just recently published, The Dolphin Papers.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite an interesting book. I read it and I couldn't put it down. It was like Cry Dance. I couldn't put Cry Dance down and I couldn't put The Dolphin Papers down. Interesting premise. Kind of sci-fi, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of sci-fi, and yet it's kind of sci-fi in the sense that it's, of course, the scientist, he's not a mad scientist, but he's a very difficult sort of a person, and he doesn't like people very well, and so we learn a lot of science, we learn a lot about our evolution, we learn a lot about communication between other species and us, and so forth, and we learn a whole lot about dolphins, because who Dr. Waller is a man who's trying to learn how to communicate with dolphins. And that means you don't wait and try to teach the dolphin to speak English. You've got to learn what the dolphin signals mean. He's working on that, but he's been unable to do that. So we're going to learn a lot about dolphins.
And we're going to learn a lot about all of the rest of that in just a minute, but we have to take a break right now. So please stay tuned, folks. You're going to learn about dolphins and Helen Bonner and everything else. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and we're talking today with Helen Bonner about her new book, The Dolphin Papers. This is great timing because right now, just recently in the movies, the Dolphin Tale came out in the movie. Have you seen that movie yet?
That one's a children's movie, and it sounds to me like it's a really good movie. It tells kids a lot about real dolphins. My book is not a children's book. As a matter of fact, it has some pretty awesome kinds of scenes in it that aren't very pretty.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's a children's book at all, for sure.
There's a death in it, for example.
Yes.
It is very much a thriller.
It is, and a lot of suspense. You wonder if he's going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dr. Waller, the scientist, this guy, he's your main character, and it's funny because usually a main character is someone that you really like and you kind of warm up to and you feel comfortable with. But Dr. Waller is a really kind of psychologically crippled man in that he cannot relate to people or live. Well, he has a good relationship with an octopus, actually.
That's right. That's as far, as he can go.
And I love the octopus. I never thought I would be fond of an octopus, but I really like. But as far, you know, and he loves the dolphin who he's named Sony, as for sonar.
Sony Sender, yeah.
For sonar, but and he loves. Well, do you want to tell about Mara?
I think we pretty much have to.
You know, yeah.
He's done what some people would say is a horrible, horrible thing here. He's done something that some people would say is a horrible, horrible thing, and other people would say he saved her life. But he's got a child in the pool, and the dolphin is basically raising the child.
That's right.
Dr. Waller didn't know how to carry a kid around or anything like that, but the dolphin does. And it's becomes, as much as he has done what he did out of all the right reasons, he's got himself into a pickle where he can't tell anybody what he's done or they'll think he's a Frankenstein.
That's right, because he does have this child who from birth has been in that pool.
That's right. She's never known anything else.
And you'll have to read the book to find out how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But so now this child is growing up. She's 6 months, and then a year, and then two, and then three, and then things really start to happen.
And beginning to be more and more and more like a dolphin.
Yeah.
More and more shaped to be a swimmer rather than a walker.
One of the really interesting things that I learned from your book, I don't think I ever knew it before, was that dolphins used to live on land. Well, they came from the sea, they moved to the land, and then in the process of evolution, they eventually went back to the sea. A lot of their bone structure is like ours.
Mm-hmm. Especially their feet, because they stood on feet very much like ours. Their bone structure was in those flukes is like our feet. And dolphins can stand around on the bottom of their tank on their flukes like we stand around a water cooler.
And we've even seen them standing, seeming to stand on the surface of the water when they're doing tricks in those horrible parts.
They're very smart. They're also, they can be tough, but they're most of the time with their own being and with humans, most of the time they're very kind. There's a lot of examples in the book. Everything that I talk about dolphins doing in the book are come from facts. I got interested in dolphins years ago from a book called Humans of the Sea, and I was fascinated with the idea, one, is that dolphins were land animals just like we were. We came from the sea also and were land animals, but we stayed there. Well, dolphins went back to the sea, and no one knows quite why. The other thing that fascinated me is if you put a newborn infant in a pool of warm water, he or she will instantly start swimming. They will hold their head up to breathe. They will swim. We don't do that, but we know that they will.
Well, I think years ago in Life magazine, I think I saw a photo essay about people who were working with infants and putting them in the water, and they discovered that these babies do know how to. Of course, they've come from amniotic fluid. They've been swimming ever since they were created.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in the womb, which is basically seawater.
Yeah. So not much difference. Mm-hmm. So we were born knowing how to swim, and then we lost that ability. Of course, also we had gills, didn't we? In the amniotic. No, we didn't.
But every once in a while, some infant will be born with gill marks that shows that eons ago, maybe we did, but it's hard to say.
It's hard to say.
We wouldn't go back that far.
Of course,
but anyway, this child came to me in my imagination because I put those two things together. The dolphins are land animals, and that an infant in the womb is very much like a dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
And I put those two together with the question about how do we understand dolphin language, because nobody has really been able to communicate with them in terms of their signals. Yes, you can teach them that this, if you give them this fish, they'll do that and so forth, but we haven't really learned their communication. And so I started wondering what would happen if instead of us trying to get the dolphin to read our signals, that we paid more attention to trying to read theirs. And here's this child that is raised by a dolphin. So although it's fiction, everything in it could actually happen. And while it's sci-fi, it's not outer space, it's something that actually could, unlikely, but could happen.
That's right. It's unlikely because nobody would really take a human infant and allow it to be raised by a dolphin.
No, we would never do that.
But the thing about Dr. Waller, too, is finally Mara, the little baby girl, she's learning to talk, and she calls him Waller, or what does she call him?
War.
That's right. And she does not ever really learn to speak, at least as far as I've read in the book, because Dr. Waller, not being very maternal, does not talk to this kid. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do anything to play with her. Mm-hmm. He just put her in the pool and let the dolphin raise her, and he's very interested. He loves her.
Mm-hmm.
He follows her. He cares about her safety and her well-being, mm-hmm. but he doesn't have the slightest idea how to interact with a baby.
No, he doesn't.
So she doesn't ever really learn English.
No,
at least
she doesn't really.
As far as your book goes.
And little by little, though, we see what happens is Waller is learning to be more human.
Yes.
Because of her.
He does become more human. And there's another character whom I love in the book who helps him to become more human, too, and that is Dolores. She is such a kick. She's from Mexico. And she speaks English pretty well, but she speaks it very creatively. And some of her expressions just had me on the floor. Gosh, I can't think of them any right now, but can you think of any of her funny?
I love Dolores, too. And what I like the most, yeah, she has her own way of taking our English idioms and turning them into something else.
Yeah.
But what I love most about her is she's just, you know, she's only 17 or 18 years old, and she doesn't take no for an answer.
That's right.
She knows what she wants, and she just keeps on until she gets it.
She's very persistent.
I think writers often fall in love with some of the characters who show up in their stories.
Yeah. And I can see that you would have fallen in love with Dolores, because I did. And then she draws Francisco into the mix. And Francisco, at first I didn't like him much. I didn't trust him.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
He grew on me after a while. And he became, I think it's Dolores. She humanized everybody.
Yeah.
She really did.
She does. Mara humanizes. Yeah, Francisco's an interesting character because, of course, he's on the lam. He's on the lam, and he's an aristocrat. And he doesn't like it that Waller, of course, when he goes to work for Waller as a handyman, Waller treats him like, you know, nobody.
And right.
He doesn't know who he really is. And that sets a very, very, very bad tone between Waller and his handyman, and that makes Francisco even more determined to find out what's in that domed pool.
That's right, because this story, The Dolphin Papers, is kind of like the old Bluebeard story that I remember from childhood. You may go anywhere, but do not go near this place.
Exactly.
And of course, Dolores and Francisco are ordered never to go near the pool. It's locked up. It's behind a wall. You do not ever go there. You don't think about it. So So, of course, how tempting is that?
Of course. First thing Francisca's going to do.
Yeah. There are two pairs in this story. There's Dolores and Francisco. They're paired. They have I can't say exactly a relationship, maybe. I don't want to give too much of the book away, but it's a tenuous situation. And then the other pair is Mara and Sony, the dolphin and the baby. And then there's Dr. Waller all by himself. And he grew on me too, because even though he's so obtuse, I came to like him and be fond of him, because it's obvious he loves this little girl and wants to do the best thing he can for her. Although he has a scientist's ego too, and he wants, this is research.
Yeah,
this is
his research,
project.
And he wishes he could show her to the world.
That's right. Well, now, Helen, we're going to have to break again. Gosh, this conversation is going very quickly. I know you want to read a little bit to us from the dolphin tale, and we want to hear it. But we'll wait until after we hear some more words from our sponsors. So everybody, please stay tuned, and Helen and I will be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field. We're talking with Helen Bonner about her new book, The Dolphin Papers. And Helen, you're going to read us a little bit from the book. Why don't you tell us about what you'll read and go ahead.
I will be starting from the very beginning of the book, because really that sets up the whole tone of the book. So here we go. The first chapter is called Genesis because it is the beginning. Hard rains off the Pacific Ocean lashed the hills north of San Diego, drove into cracked stucco walls of the isolated marine laboratory, streamed in rivulets down the tarnished copper spokes of a soaring Spanish dome. A black van slowed in the roadway, paused for a few seconds, then raced away. Inside the cluttered laboratory, Dr. Al Waller, once a famous marine biologist, was mixing a protein shrimp compound for a dyspeptic octopus when he heard a pathetic, haunting cry, "Ayudame! Help me!" Was it the wind or his imagination? No one dared pass the keep out signs down by the gate. He went on feeding Octo. The animal wrapped its tentacles around his wrist and raised its huge head out of the water. Waller admired Octo. The most highly developed of the invertebrates, he housed a well-developed brain in that ugly cartilaginous case. "We're a pair, old boy," he chuckled, drying his hands on the front of his well-filled lab coat. "You're all head, and I'm all body." The call came again. "Ayudame!" No mistaking it this time. A high voice. Teenage boy, probably. And mother's skinny, hope-filled Mexican wetback, risking his life to be an underpaid busboy in some L.A. night spot. They straggled across the border continually. He'd not get involved. Let the border patrol do their work. The wind paused for a breather. In the silence, he stopped and listened. Nothing. Did he leave? Or was someone still out there? In a neighboring tank, the koalakant, half-fish, half-land creature, crawled ponderously out of the water on rotating pelvic fins, pushing itself across a shelf of rock with paddle-like pectoral fins. "Oh, father fish," Waller ran his finger along the glass, "the first to crawl from the sea. Rare, valuable, the koalakanth was the closest living relative to the prehistoric fishes that gave rise to amphibians and began the chain of animals that led to humans. And we're not through evolving yet, no matter what they say." Again the cry, trailing off. "Ayudame!" Whoever was out in that dump car was not going away. Sighing, he hunched his shoulders against the rain and shambled across the central patio into the sala, the old resort's once grand entrance, now a storeroom for unpacked boxes stacked on the heavy hand-carved chairs. He'd long since given up thinking he'd unpack them one of these days. By the dim light of the wrought iron chandelier, he rummaged about in sagging cardboard boxes of hoses, pump parts, and scientific journals until he finally found a rain slicker and a flashlight. Coming across his old target pistol, he sighted it at the wrought iron ceiling fixture, hoping he wouldn't have to use it. The gun was probably unloaded anyway, but he tucked it under his belt. Threats were usually enough. In the arched stucco doorway, he turned on the floodlights and peered out. Brilliant light shone on the potholed asphalt parking lot, slick and empty. No one in sight, not even the old horse that sometimes grazed by the fence. Pulling his slicker tight, he stepped out into the rain. Cold rivulets streamed down his collar, soaking his undershirt. He threw the flashlight beam under the giant eucalyptus, its bark forever peeling like torn skin. Nothing. No one behind the truck either. But as he swung the light under the truck, he saw something hardly discernible from a pile of old clothing. Waller stepped back. Someone there? Why hadn't the wretch crawled into the cab out of the wind and rain? Was this a setup for a robbery? He snorted aloud. What a disappointment that would be. A water-smeared checkbook, often in the red, a lonely cetacean, and a sick cephalopod. He circled at a safe distance, shouting the only Spanish that came to him. Avanzarle! Come forward. Even when he swung the powerful beam under the truck, the figure remained a sodden, silent mass, motionless. Groaning, Waller got to his knees and peered under the low, greasy engine. Light fell on a delicate, smooth young face, partially hidden in mud-matted strings of long black hair. A woman. Blood oozed from a deep gash on the side of her head, and one cheek was scraped raw. Even in the bright glare, she didn't open her eyes. Waller stood up, arching his back to ease the pain, and glared at the heavens. Damn. Dropping to his knees again, he crawled into the light, oily space, and pushed his slicker under her limp body. Backing out, he got a firm hold and dragged her out, feet first, cringing as her head bumped against the pavement. But he had no choice. One hand easing his back, he shone the light across the still figure sprawled face up in the rain. He noted the cheap nylon dress, torn in places, and over that, a man's athletic jacket. Her high-heeled shoes, cracked patent leather, seemed ridiculous, pathetic, but somehow touching. Everything about her said made in Mexico in every sense of the word. Coyotes, wretched men who took money to get desperate people across the Mexican border, sometimes shoved them out of vans on these lonely back roads. From the look of her lacerations, this son of a shark had not even slowed down. People! Their treachery against one another was like no other species. He scanned the shadows, the shabby eucalyptus trees beyond the drive, half hoping someone would materialize to take her off his hands. No such luck. The rain came harder, beating on the tiled roof. He had to get her inside. Something tells me I'm going to hate myself for this. Getting his arms under her, he stumbled awkwardly, nearly dropped her, the vertebrae at the base of his spine sending sparks of pain. He had to brace his back against the truck before he could get moving a second time. And then he lunged through the gate crab rise, using her feet to push the gate open. Breathing hard, he heaved her onto the long wooden bench in the sala. She groaned. Sorry, he said, but I didn't exactly invite you. Her eyes remained closed. Her hair smelled like muddy fur. In the glare of the one dangling light bulb, she looked pale and very young. 17? 18? She had the perfect classic features of many Mexican women, sculpted wing-like eyebrows over a straight, narrow nose, delicate, high cheekbones. Neither beautiful nor unbeautiful right now, just a problem he didn't want or need. Always happier with marine animals than with people, he certainly didn't want a nursemaid this one. "I'm no Florence Nightingale," he growled. Her eyes remained closed. He'd get her out of here as fast as he could. Let the border patrol take over. Ducking through the double doors that swung into the laboratory, he grabbed a towel from the pile next to the cluttered examination table and, hurrying back, wiped the girl's tangled hair away from the wound. Looked bad. The cut was deep, blood already clotting. He examined abrasions on her legs, arms, and hips. Bad. Her dark skin was blue under her eyes. She felt as cold and clammy as one of his fish. Pulling off the wet dress, she rubbed the towel briskly under her blue-veined breasts, across her wide hips and rounded belly. She stiffened. Her eyelids flooded. "Don't worry, lady. This might be some man's fantasy, undressing a mysterious young señorita in the midnight hours, but I could do nicely without whatever soap opera you've gotten me into." He wrapped her in a fishy-smelling blanket from his bed. Hypothermia, probably. Extreme exposure. Shock. Probably internal injuries as well. This is more serious than he was prepared to handle. In the lab, he searched for the phone by the fish tank's yellow light, found it under heaps of papers, then got only a buzz of brittle static. Damn. The phone never worked when it rained, and the truck had a flat. To get help, he'd have to walk all the way to the gas station, at least a mile, and a steep uphill climb returning. The rain would make it worse. Could she survive the wait? In the old commercial kitchen, rummaging around the fish-smelling sink and the ancient black stove smelling of grease, he found a bottle of scotch and poured a jigger to prepare himself for a rainy hike. Ah, that's better. It warmed him like a mother's hug. Not that his mother ever hugged him, blue-stocking intellectual that she'd been. He took another jigger to his patient and, lifting her head, tipped a dose between her parted lips. She writhed, coughing. Her eyes fluttered open. "Jesus, Maria!" Her cry held such pain that Al was glad he'd left medicine decades ago. "What happened?" he asked. "Qué pasa?" Her attempts to talk came in weak gasps. "Coyotes, pagar, frontera." He understood only a little Spanish, but he understood that much. Smugglers had taken her money, then dumped her on the road, probably leaving her for dead. Who knows how far she had crawled to get shelter under that truck. He put on the muddy slicker. "I'm going for help," he said, more to himself than to her. As he headed for the door, she reached out, got hold of the edge of the slicker, and held on. Her eyes met his with a desperate gaze. "Save my baby," she begged, spoken perfectly.
Wow. Stay tuned. We will be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field. We're talking with Helen Bonner, and in the last segment you heard Helen read the opening of her book, The Dolphin Papers, and I hope that makes you want to go buy the book. I think you know now where he found the baby that he puts in the pool. Mm-hmm. It's a tragic beginning, very tragic beginning. I wonder how that poor mother would feel knowing what happened with her baby. Certainly a unique child and unique experiences.
You know, what happens to that baby, people are going to feel differently about it when they read the book, because some people are going to see it one way, as she's free, and other people are going to see it another way.
That's right. That's right. But we will say no more about the Dolphin Papers because we just want to raise your interest so you go out there and buy that book. And Helen, it's available on Amazon, isn't it?
Amazon and also at Hine & Company Books here in Jackson.
And can they get any from you directly?
They can always get them from me directly by going to H. Bonner Books, hbonnerbooks.com.
And then you'll autograph it and mail it to him?
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
And mail it.
So it's HBONNER Books.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy enough.
.com.
Oh, while we're doing that, let me remind you, we want to thank the Calaveras County Arts Council, who has us sheltered so nicely and comfortably under their umbrella. They do wonderful things for Manzanita Writers Press and Writers Unlimited. And I'd like to direct you to the Manzanita Writers Press website so you can learn more about who we are and what we do. That's www.manzapress.com. That's manzapress.com. Please email me and tell me what you thought of the show today with Helen Bonner. You can do that at writers@kvgcradio.com. And as I said in the beginning of the program, I'm hoping that by the time you're hearing this in early November, I will already have my website up and running with all of our previous radio programs, including Helen's, archived on the website. So you can listen at your leisure whenever you want to. No longer do you have to pull yourself out of bed or make yourself late for church on Sunday mornings. You can listen at midnight on Friday if you want to or whatever. Anyway, that's enough time with that because I want to get back to Helen. She's such an interesting guest. Helen, we have so much to talk about and we're running out of time. You've published 4 books, 2 memoirs, one called The Laid Daughter, the other called First Love Last. I wish we had time to talk about those, but you're just going to have to come back someday. Then there is Cry Dance, the novel, which was very, very interesting. I liked that. And now your Dolphin Papers. But that's not all you've done. You were professor of English at Minnesota State University. You have a PhD in creative writing, communications, and screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And you won an award in school for your screenplay it was called A Higher Loyalty, and it was about the Jeanette Rankin story. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
The Jeanette Rankin screenplay came about while I was researching, looking for a topic to write a screenplay about, and I stumbled across this information on Jeanette Rankin, and here I am, as highly educated as most people, and I never heard of her before. And that really piqued my curiosity because Jeanette Rankin was the first woman to ever get elected to Congress. And the most fascinating thing about her was women didn't have the right to vote yet. That means men elected her. It just fascinated me. She was an incredible woman. And I wanted people to know more about her. So,
she was obviously very persuasive.
Oh, she was a woman of her time. She was a Montana woman, and when she was younger, she could either be the gracious lady with her long silk skirts because her mother was a teacher and she's well brought up, but she could also work in the logging mill with her father.
Wow.
She was quite a woman.
Hmm.
And, you know, those rugged states were the first ones to give women the vote because women were used to being independent in those states, where in places like New York they weren't, and they were the last to give women the vote.
That's interesting. That's true, I guess. The women in the rugged states had to prove themselves because
right. There
was a lot of work to be done and the men couldn't do it all.
Well, that's right.
Well, I'm going to have to look up your screenplay. Is it available for anyone to find?
It's still an option, actually. At the time they were ready to make it, a PBS special came out that pretty much gave all the information, so they postponed it, so it's still an option. So it's not available anywhere except through me.
Oh, okay. Well, my goodness. Well, now, tell me, what is the difference? What are some of the differences between writing a screenplay or any play versus writing a novel. There's a tremendous difference, I know. Which one is more difficult? And what do you have to, what kinds of things do you have to know?
Each genre is very, very different from the other. You might think of yourself, if you're into writing a novel, as you are not only the director, you are the actors, you are everything. When you're writing a screenplay, you have a director, you have a cameraman, you have all of those people, you have actors and so forth, to help you bring that to life. So it's almost like the screenplay writer has to write a very, very good skeleton, and that's a very different art, and then let all those other people I just mentioned bring it to life. But you still have to have your vision of who those characters are, so that it comes across clearly to the professionals who are going to bring that to life. They're two very, very different. Most people, especially young students, they'll say to me, "I always wanted to write a screenplay." Well, that's because they've always seen movies. But it isn't that easy.
I'm sure it's not. I mean, a novelist does a lot of descriptive writing, describing her flowing blonde hair and his flashing eyes and the beautiful scenery and everything. But where does a screenplay writer put all that description? They don't put it in the...
Very, very little of it. Most of your screenplay writing is either an action or a dialogue. Action, dialogue.
And they also have to say where the actor is standing, center stage, stage left, stage right.
Well, for plays you do, but for screenplays you don't.
Oh, you don't.
No, that's the director's job.
So do you talk about cameras then, camera angles, camera shots? No, that's the director does that.
That's the director's job and the cameraman's job.
I think it'd be interesting.
In the old days, they did.
Oh, they did.
Yeah, they would have all that camera angle stuff. Not anymore. That's far too complex. What the screenplay writer has to do is get that story across and get those characters across and get how they talk across in such a way that whoever reads it goes, "Wow, I know how I want to produce this."
How many descriptive words would be used then? Say if there's a couple is having an argument and one of them is manipulating something in their hand, showing that they're angry. How do you write that?
You would write that because that's an action.
Ah.
And between the dialogue, unless you could have a person, of course, being very, very angry without saying a word. But if you're doing that, then you're going to have to show some action that shows how angry that person is, putting his fist through a wall or whatever he's doing. Your job as a screenwriter is to get it across to the person who's most likely to pass it on to a producer or a director, to get them to visualize what's going on there without doing what a novelist does, which describes the whole thing in detail, including tone and background and every blink of the eye. It's a different art.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would be very different. I'm going to look and see if I can maybe someday take a screenwriting class just to see how it is. But now you taught obviously creative writing in the university. For people who have difficulty writing, what advice do you give them? You know, someone who says, "Well, I'm not a writer. I never could write. But now here I'm in this class and I'm supposed to write." How do you loosen them up?
I would probably ask that person why they were in this class.
Why are you here?
Yeah, if they never had attempted any kind of writing, because after all, writing is writing, and most people who have a real aptitude for writing have been writing in one way or another.
And keeping
a journal, even, you know.
It
doesn't have to be a big thing, but writers write, just like artists draw from the time they're kids. Once in a while you get a person who has never written anything, but it's pretty rare. you get a person to say, but I've never written anything. And then you talk to them and you find out, oh, they've kept a journal their whole life.
Or they've written letters.
Or they have all these letters that they've written that are great descriptions of things. And people who want to write usually have been writing something.
It forces its way out somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But they maybe don't have confidence. I know I've had at least one or two people on this program, and I've met a lot of other people who have joined a writer's group, and they say, oh, I never thought I was a writer. And it turns out that they write very well. One of them is Jennifer Tristano. She was on this show. She has completed her fantasy novel, and it's very, very, very good. And yet she grew up thinking that she hated writing and would never, ever want to do it. And darn it, Helen, I wish we had more time, but I'm looking at the clock, and we're out of time. This hour has gone so fast.
Well, it's been so much fun to be here.
Well, maybe you can come back someday. I'll tell you what, when you write your next book.
My next book, I'll be back.
Are you working on one?
Oh, I am always writing another book. There's another one coming.
Well, that's good. Okay, well, we'll see you again then. I look forward to it. And thank you for coming and joining us today.
Thank you, Linda.
Have a great week, everybody. Glad you could join us with Helen Bonner today. Don't forget her book, The Dolphin Papers. You can order it direct from Helen, autograph copy at hbonnerbooks.com. And check out my website. I hope it's up and running, and I hope this is really the name of it. Linda Field at manzamedia.com. If it's there, and if I've got the name right, then you'll find all these shows archived. And don't forget to send me your Christmas and holiday writing also. It can be 5 minutes long. And your morning workout stuff. 2 minutes. Okay, that's it. I've got to go. See you next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.